Gordon. This is The Connection. One day after Ukraine's fraudulent election in late November, the first of those orange scarves appeared in Kiev, and tents sprang up in the city square. Opposition leader Viktor Yushchenko, his face disfigured from an attempt to poison him with dioxin, became the rallying figure for a country weary from its years under communism and then corruption. And yet behind what seemed like a spontaneous people's revolution were years of preparation and millions of dollars in help from countries like the United States. We'll look at this kind of democratic success in places like Ukraine this hour, and of course the question mark that still hangs over the new government in Kyrgyzstan. We'd also like to talk about the American role in growing democracy through support of civic institutions. First, though, a chance to reflect once again on the turnaround in Ukraine. The new president, Viktor Yushchenko, is currently in the United States. He'll address a joint session of Congress this evening. You can expect a room full of congressional lapels, each pinned with a small orange ribbon. Yesterday, Yushchenko was in Boston at the John F. Kennedy Library to receive this year's Profile in Courage Award.
Today, after the victorious Orange Revolution, I cannot separate what I accomplished from what was accomplished by the courageous acts of the Ukrainian people. I'm proud that my nation demonstrated its strength, peacefully and beautifully defended its freedom. I'm happy that my fellow citizens subscribe to the great values of democracy. I also view this award as a recognition of all Ukrainians who stood up to defend their human dignity, democracy, and rule of law. These are the values which we profess together with the democratic world and that we are ready to defend. I believe that Ukraine and the United States will defend them together as strategic partners.
Yushchenko's final words to the crowd in Boston were telling. He said, "God bless America and God protect Ukraine." This hour, we're looking at the U.S. role in supporting democratic movements like that of Viktor Yushchenko's. We'd like to hear your opinions. Should the United States be in the business of building democracy abroad? Is this the kind of work you want your taxpayer dollars going towards? And if so, how does the United States decide which countries get the support? Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And I'm joined this hour by two guests in a studio in Washington. Thomas Carruthers is director of the Democracy and Rule of Law Project at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Thomas, it's good of you to join us.
Good to be here.
And there in the same studio with you, Adrian Karanetsky. He is a counselor and a senior scholar at Freedom House in New York. Adrian, thank you for coming in as well.
Hi.
And I suppose, Adrian, as the son of Ukrainian immigrants, there's some pride in watching Mr. Yushchenko rather than Mr. Kuchma or some of his predecessors in America this week.
Well, I think that's right. But I also think that the real moment of pride was the rise of a mature, dignified, nonviolent, and relatively sophisticated civic movement that led the processes and steered them in that direction. I mean, Yushchenko has been on the scene for a number of years. He served as prime minister. He is a wonderful guy, and it's great that he now has a democratic mandate. But it really was these broader transformations that I think are more the guarantors of Ukraine's democratic future than simply individuals and personalities. And I'm glad that in his address, Yushchenko seemed to, Boston, Yushchenko seemed to find the proper balance and the proper, not false humility, but sort of objective description of the processes that led to the political opening.
No, you're quite right. He said, "I stood up, but what was more important was that the Ukrainian people stood up." And we want to talk about this hour is what helped give them the strength and the wherewithal to do that. Because while we look at these people's revolutions in places like Serbia and Georgia and most recently in Kiev and think, isn't it wonderful to see that kind of spontaneous thing happening? There is a lot of work that goes into the support of civic institutions. How much of that work, Adrian, went on behind the scenes prior to what we saw in November?
Well, I do think, you know, there was a sort of a, you know, a tipping point reached in the consciousness of Ukrainians that their government was corrupt and capable of massive voter fraud. And this took a number of years. There were a series of scandals and revelations, murders of journalists, auto accidents that seemed like political assassinations. And while the state television was mainly controlled by the government, there were independent cable stations, there was some independent radio, there were a number of independent newspapers, and the internet, and people sort of got word of what was going on. The most important thing that happened was that the revolution occurred in Kiev, which is, there are about 5 million individual internet access points in Ukraine, and about 40 to 50% of them are found in Kiev. There are a lot of in the Kiev region more broadly, and so I think this was the most connected, the most worldwide city, and it was the city that was ready to lead this process. At the same time, there was an investment since really the beginning of Ukrainian independence in the early 90s, 91 and forward, supporting, you know, think tanks, policy groups, training of journalists, dialogue, the you know, providing some material support to stimulate a discussion about what, you know, democratic virtue is about, and to raise the threshold, I would say, of citizen expectations. And that was a sort of a slower and more incremental process. At the same time, the other reason that this moved forward was that there was a creation of a business sector. There's a lot of talk about the Ukrainian Revolution being a struggle between the billionaires versus the millionaires, meaning the new arrivals, the new guys on the block who don't want to have a corrupt government, don't want to have a corrupt tax authority interfering in their business affairs. They'd like to just get on with the process of growing the economy. Lots of middle class and upper middle class people who supported this revolution. Mm-hmm. So a combination of what was going on in the society, a combination of external support came together and reached this sort of a tipping point, plus the fact that there were a lot of revelations about the nature of the corruption, because a security service operative actually audio taped the former Ukrainian president's conversations and brought out over 1,000 hours of these tapes, many of which kind of resurfaced through independent media back in Ukraine, and the public began to understand just how malign and corrupt their government was.
And Thomas Carruthers, all that money, that civic support, that investment in democracy, is it all a bit of a gamble? Does it all go into a country like Ukraine with the hope that at some point there will be one of those tipping points, those moments that Adrian described?
Yes, I think that's true to some extent. In many countries around the world, both the United States and Europe, both public and private organizations are in supporting civil society, working with independent media, helping new business associations, and the kinds of things that Adrian described. In some places, there's really the clear hope that in the next 3 or 4 or 5 years, there will be a tipping point in such a moment. But in many other places where the situation is fairly bleak, it's more of a generational kind of investment. The idea is that this is just a good thing to do, whether it produces a tipping point or not. It's going to help build political space. It's going to make people's lives better. And it's worth doing in and of itself. And we have to be careful here of not being too instrumental in looking at targets and saying, we don't like this particular leader. If we just invest X million dollars in this kind of assistance, we could get rid of him. It's the wrong way to think about this kind of assistance. And it leads to a pushback, which is what's occurring in some parts of the former Soviet Union, by leaders who suddenly say, we thought this was just innocent civil society work. We now see what the real nature of it is.
And there's a history in this country of making too much of an investment or being too public or using soldiers or guns. I'm thinking more of Latin America in the Reagan years rather than the example of Iraq, which would be the one that would jump to attention. Is this country learning anything about just how and where and with how much sort of money and clout and influence to go into countries that need this kind of assistance, this nudge towards democracy?
Well, I think we are, actually. And in Latin America, you know, when I started working in this kind of democracy promotion work in the 1980s, if you said to a Latin American, the United States wants to promote democracy in Latin America, the typical reaction was a person would burst into laughter, tears, and say, you must be kidding. We know what the history of your country is. It's political manipulation. It's keeping goons in power because they're good for you.
Right.
So a couple of important things have changed. In at least some countries, but not everywhere in the world, the United States now sees that dictators are not really in our interest, even if they provide some short-term economic and security goals, although we still have friendly relationships with dictators, I would say, in a number of countries. And secondly, it's important that we do this work on the basis of principle, that we do it openly, that we say what we're doing, that we follow certain, we respect certain principles of civil society values and democratic values, and not do it in the dark and not apologize for what we're doing and not do it in a, as I said, instrumental kind of way, but rather to serve certain kinds of values. So overall change in our policy partially, although we could talk about many exceptions to that, and a change in how we do it to the kinds of organizations like the National Endowment for Democracy and our aid agency, USAID, right, and many other organizations that do this above the board and are proud of what they do it and do it in the light of public scrutiny rather than covertly.
And Adrian, if it works, is there a knock-on effect from a place like Ukraine? Do people refer to that as, see, it can work?
Well, if you know, we do this annual exercise called the Map of Freedom, and in a sense, you see that freedom spreads almost geographically. Contiguous states, there tend to be clusters of states, and democratic processes tend to occur in, you know, affine locations, whether they are culturally affine or geographically proximate. I think it's just natural that the influence of borders, particularly if there are common languages, people followed what went on in Poland under Solidarity, and certainly that inspired the breakthroughs in 89. I mean, it was a much more complicated process, but that was one of the things. And I think there does tend to be that kind of a trigger, and that we do see waves. You know, there was a sort of a Latin American wave of liberalization and democratization in the 80s. We saw one in Central Eastern Europe in the late 80s, and so there is something to that. I do think that people, I think Thomas is right about this, that we can't be too instrumental in our focus, that there isn't a magic formula. This is a very, very complicated thing that
we need
requires.
To just stop you there, because we're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll talk about another place where this is still in the testing ground. We're going to talk with Adil Basalov, chairman of the Coalition for Democracy in Bishkek, Kyrgyzstan, where the transition in power is still in something of question. We'd like to hear from you as well. 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. President George Bush came to office 5 years ago, certainly with the expectation in the country that he would not be in the business of nation building, spending a lot of time and energy promoting democracy outside the borders of this country. Of course, events changed that for him, and his own view has been changed by events outside the Middle East as he looks at what's happening in places like Ukraine, for example. A little bit earlier this week, he was welcoming Ukraine's new president, Yushchenko, to the White House and made a comment about the spread of democracy.
The Orange Revolution represented revolutions elsewhere as well. And look forward to working with you, Mr. President. Places like Lebanon and Kyrgyzstan. I want to thank you for your conversation on Moldova. I appreciate the discussion we had about Belarus.
Well, there's a list of countries which are in the neighborhood of Ukraine. We talked earlier about the way that democracy can spread across a border. Time to speak briefly with Adil Basalov. He is chairman of the Coalition for Democracy and Civil Society in Kyrgyzstan. He's joining us on the line from the capital there in Bishkek. Adil, thanks for making a few moments for us.
Thank you.
There was a headline this weekend in the New York Times saying Kyrgyzstan's shining hour ticks away and turns out to be a plain old coup. Do you think that's accurate?
Well, not exactly so. There are very high expectations from, you know, both inside the country and outside. And, of course, there is some frustration. But I think we all need to realize that the revolution which we had on March 24 is only the start of a very long and difficult road.
Do you think that you can turn this into something that looks more democratic? As I look at the details of what's going on, I see the North battling with the South and the judiciary with Parliament and everybody grabbing for their little bit of power, and I'm afraid that it looks like it's too much of an internal battle rather than one country's push towards democracy.
Well, I think it's everything, you know, it looks like a democracy. In a democracy, you are supposed to have competitive politics and you have to have competing political parties. You know, many of my compatriots, they think that, oh, now we're going to have civil war. Now, look, this, you know, northern leader is going to fight southern leader. But, you know, it's because we are not used to democracy. We are not used to pluralistic society. You know, we're just coming out of an authoritarian country, and for 70 years we lived in the totalitarian regime in the Soviet Union. So I think we need to downplay all those, you know, reports. What we're now focused on is really having free and fair elections, and the outcome of which should be accepted by everybody.
Adil, the United States did provide some support for civil society in Kyrgyzstan prior to this. I don't know how important that was in your view, but what's to be done now?
Well, just like as I said, you know, this is only the beginning. We cannot, you know, we cannot assume that now democracy will flourish and Kyrgyzstan will prosper. What needs to be done is really support the environment where various political parties, various regional groups, ethnic groups can find their own voice and can feel confident to voice their concerns or opinion. And it's very important is to build free media, you know, to turn our national television into a sort of BBC or National Public Radio of, you know, Kyrgyzstan.
What I'm wondering, though, Adil, if I can just interrupt you for a minute, is if people came in from the youth movements in Serbia and Georgia and Ukraine, people who were involved in helping build democracy in those countries, if young Democrats from the United States came in with their ideas, would that be a good thing or a bad thing? Is this the moment for the Kyrgyz people to do the work that you're talking about?
Well, I think, you know, we can benefit from experience and expertise of Eastern Europeans or, you know, from other parts of the world. We certainly can, but of course it's a road which we, or, you know, the Kyrgyz ourselves, we need to accomplish, you know. Nothing can be exported or imported. We need to do it and learn ourselves, but most certainly we can benefit from experience and lessons learned by others.
Adil, I want to thank you for being with us on the program. I know you're a busy man.
Thank you.
Adil Basalov, chairman of the Coalition for Democracy and Civil Society in Bishkek, Kyrgyzstan. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. And lots of people want to join this conversation. So as we take the test of how much and how involved the United States should be in the assistance of building democracy around the world, we're going to start in Fort Drum, New York. Barry is on the line. Hi, Barry.
Hey, how are you? Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
One of the questions you asked, I think the main question you asked, was whether we should be involved. And I believe we should definitely be involved in helping build democracies. First of all, because it is the right thing to do. From a right-wrong standpoint, it is the right thing to do. But more from a standpoint of our history has taught us over and over again that we cannot just simply ignore what's going on in other countries as if it's not going to affect us.
Barry, what's the test, though? How far do you go? Does it all have to be below the radar? Does it sometimes, could it, should it sometimes involve strong political statements like, you know, putting a list of countries on, naming a list of countries as tyrannies in a presidential State of the Union speech or even using soldiers? How far do you go?
Well, I think, like it was said earlier, I believe that there is no magic formula. You have to be willing to do what it takes to do what will work, and no formula is going to work. What's working in Afghanistan right now, and I believe what we're doing in Afghanistan is right and it's working, as well as in Iraq, in both of those theaters. But what works there is not what's going to work everywhere else. We couldn't have charged into the Ukraine with guns a-blazing. That wouldn't have worked there, I don't believe. You have to have a different formula and be constantly re-looking at what's working and what's not working, and we do that.
All right, Barry, I thank you for your call. I want to actually just listen to both my guests reflect on that idea of tailoring a formula to the country in particular. Adrian Karanitsky is with me. He's a counselor and senior scholar at Freedom House in New York. And Thomas Carruthers, Director of Democracy and Rule of Law Project at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Thomas, maybe you can start on that sensitivity of how you look at a country and figure out exactly what will work and what won't.
Well, it is really a difficult question. And, you know, over the last 20 years, the United States, as well as a number of European countries, have been trying to promote democracy around the world. And knowledge has only been accumulating slowly. And I think a lot of Americans, when they hear about the United States promoting democracy, are inherently skeptical. And there's nothing wrong with starting with skepticism because of the history of our country of sometimes messing around in other people's politics for the wrong reasons. But there is gradually some learning starting to emerge that, you know, you can not, you know, you're not a doctor coming to a patient and saying you have these three problems and take this pill and you'll be fine in the morning. But politics does have patterns. And so we see, for example, in the former Soviet Union, certain kinds of semi-authoritarian regimes that have certain practices. We know they allow a certain amount of space that allows an opportunity for political organizing of this type. In other places that are more repressive, you know, the situation's harder. You can do different kinds of things, probably fewer things. Or in countries that are more open but are having their own problems with political legitimacy or accountability, you can do other things. So we have to be wary of any idea that there's some kind of set toolbox. Yet on the other hand, this isn't just sort of blindly reaching out and saying, hey, we'd like to do something. What can we do? There is a sort of a professional world emerging of democracy promoters, who I think for the most part are pretty well-intentioned. Their political bosses aren't always, who know something about what they're doing. And they don't have miracle cures. We can't take a country. Look at Cuba. You know, we've been trying to promote democracy in Cuba for 45 years. It's a weak, small country, 90 miles from our coastline. It's a dictatorship today. So we have to be pretty humble about what we can really accomplish. But if we are humble, we're serious about the task, we're willing to put at least a modest amount of resources in it, then it's probably worth doing.
And Adrian, you listen.
I think Thomas raised an interesting point. He said that in the past, the U.S. had a reputation for messing around in other people's, other countries' politics. What we're doing now is that we're actually giving resources for people to mess around in their own country's politics, which is what democracy ought to be about. We're kind of looking and empowering people across a political spectrum so that they can take part constructively in the give and take of politics. They can challenge their leaders. They can monitor corruption. They can, you know, they can advocate for women's rights. They can advocate for environmental issues. And they can monitor elections. Adil, who was just on the line, headed up a delegation that Freedom House was involved in supporting with USAID resources. We brought 1,000 people from around the region to monitor Ukraine's elections. He spent a couple months living in Kiev and sort of absorbed the atmosphere and I think has established some contacts which would help, I think, him not in fomenting a revolution but in thinking through if Bishkek is moving towards and Kyrgyzstan is moving towards reform, there will be networks of people who can be you know, engaged in assisting them who have gone through similar sets of problems in moving away from, you know, semi-authoritarianism or authoritarian and corrupt rule into more open and participatory rule. So, you know, I think that type of profile of activity, and I think a degree of detachment. That is to say, it is wrong. You know, no one worked for Yushchenko, at least in my organization and in the aid programs. We worked to make sure there was a level playing field and that the votes were counted accurately. And I think that's the point. We shouldn't be championing individuals. We should, as Tom has said, be championing particular processes, institutions, and so forth.
1-800-423-8255. What are the components needed for the formation of a viable democracy, and how far can one country go in offering its muscle to another country or people in another country to do that work themselves? 1-800-423-TALK. Next to Littleton, Massachusetts, Terry's joining us on the phone. Hello, Terry.
Hey, what's up?
We're doing fine. Where are you?
I'm in high school. I'm in English class right now. We were just listening to your broadcast, and we found something funny about this. There seems to be a lot of correlations between the Ukrainian government and how the book Julius Caesar ended up.
What are you suggesting here?
What's that?
What are you suggesting here?
I don't know. I was just told to call. If I read the book, I might be able to help you more on this.
Well, I'm wondering if there are people who will look at the involvement of the United States and say that this is too much about spreading an American image of democracy, American empire, in places where the U.S. doesn't have any kind of role or any kind of business.
But you know, can I just make a comment about,
sure,
you know, U.S. empire? It's not always U.S. influence. The first act that Yushchenko announced, which has relevance to the United States, is his commitment to withdraw the Ukrainian contingent from the Iraq, from the Iraqi international peacekeeping forces. So this is not exactly a sign of a purely hegemonic leadership in the U.S. installing a favored candidate. And the reason he was able to do it was because he's responsive to the people, and the people in Ukraine felt that it was a bit remote from Ukraine's interests to be sending troops to police Iraq. And the only reason the troops were sent in the first place was because the former president was so corrupt and in such trouble in his relations with the United States that he offered this as a way of repairing relations, because he was accused of and found complicit in so many acts of misbehavior and corruption.
At the same time, it's interesting that, you know, in the former Soviet Union, it's an unusual region, this is Thomas Carruthers, in that you have less of a legacy of the United States meddling in people's politics there. And so, on the whole, people in the former Soviet Union are somewhat less sensitive than they are, say, in Latin America or in Africa, to the idea of the United States coming and funding political work of one type or another. If you go to Venezuela right now, for example, Hugo Chavez and many Venezuelans who support him is extremely sensitive about the idea that the United States should come in and fund civic groups or opposition parties or things like that if it's thinking of doing that. And so we have to, you know, realize that, yes, there are real sensitivities and there are real reasons for those sensitivities. And the former Soviet Union is actually somewhat unusual in its tolerance of this. I'd say Eastern Europe was maybe in that camp as well. But elsewhere in the world, the sensitivities are very high. We saw that with Zimbabwe recently in the elections there. And so, again, differentiation is needed. We have to recognize that we may feel that some of this assistance is well-intentioned, but others are going to start from a point of extreme skepticism.
Let's go to Columbia, South Carolina. Jose's listening in. Hello, Jose.
Good morning, Dick.
What do you think?
Well, I don't mind the United States supporting countries that lean toward democracy, and if they don't, we can use sanctions or negotiations or mediation, all that.
Yeah.
But this militaristic stuff, this military force to force democracy on it, I completely disagree with that strongly.
And so that's the line. Like, it's fine to help out election monitors or build up the free media in a country or provide them with that kind of support. But as soon as soldiers and weapons become involved?
No. That Iraq thing is completely ridiculous. We got a lot of lost lives for nothing. Lost lives and lost limbs for absolutely zero.
And does it mean then to you, Jose, that maybe this country hasn't learned the lesson that it might have learned back in the 1980s?
No, it hasn't. Not good enough. Not nearly good enough, sir.
I guess, Thomas, if we use Iraq as an example, there are people all over the world who say that was too far, too much, too far.
It's true. There's, you know, one way to draw lines to say don't use military force, but I think that's too simple, because, you know, actually a lot of people, 11 years ago, the United States intervened militarily in Haiti to remove a rather nasty group of military people running that country and tried to attempt to restore an elected president. And a lot of the same people who didn't like the Iraq war supported that intervention. So I don't think we can just draw the line and say military bad, other means good.
Mm-hmm.
The Haiti intervention was different in a couple of ways. First, we had approval of the United Nations for the intervention in a more substantial way than we did for Iraq. Secondly, nobody in the world really suspected we were going into Haiti for natural resources or for strategic interests. Haiti doesn't present those. And so the intervention looked more humanitarian than Iraq looked to many people in the world. And thirdly, though it turned out to be wrong, it kind of looked more possible. Haiti didn't look like a very difficult military campaign. It didn't look like it would be all that hard to restore the leader and get things going. It hasn't worked out very well. So the point is, I don't think we should just draw the line and say military bad, other means good. We should draw a different line, which says, you know, we need some consensus on this. We need a realistic sense that this is something we can do, that the costs are going to be less than the benefits, and so forth.
It's certainly the case that societies that are ravaged with a lot of violence have a disruption of sort of civic life and the opportunity, you know, the ability for civil society to restore itself and to function. And certainly those are not very good environments. And the record of sort of post-military intervention democracy construction is fairly spotty. I mean, it was not so bad in the post-World War II era, but I think it more recently these types of interventions have a pretty mixed record. Certainly the intervention in Haiti ended up with another intervention to get rid of the guy that we helped reassert democratically legitimate power. This time we came in and kind of urged him to leave.
Okay, Connection listeners, 1-800-423-8255. Are there times when even the show of force in relatively benign circumstances can be a useful way of promoting democracy? Or do you draw the kind of line that Jose does, where if there's guns involved, somehow you've crossed a line? How can the U.S. use its strength to support democracy around the world? 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Later this evening, the new president of Ukraine, Viktor Yushchenko, will be addressing a joint session of Congress, talking a little bit about his plans for that country and also acknowledging some of the support that the U.S. gave to the growth of the democracy movement in Ukraine. With me on the program, Adrian Karanetsky, counselor, senior scholar at Freedom House in New York, and someone who was certainly involved in the development of democracy in Ukraine, Thomas Carruthers, director of Democracy and Rule of Law Project at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, also author of a new book coming out called Uncharted Journey, Promoting Democracy in the Middle East. That's something that we should talk a little bit about because that area has its own particular interests. 1-800-423-TALK. Let's go to Louisville, Kentucky. Brent's on the line. Hello, Brent.
Hi. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah.
I've just become really concerned about our intervention in the Middle East. Looking at the fact that we've been intervening in the Middle East since the post-World War II era, one of your guest speakers brought that up.
Yeah.
Iran came to mind, and I'm wondering by this military interaction in Iraq, if we haven't kind of messed up a potential really positive situation in a very young country. I think something like 70% of the population in Iran is under 35 years of age due to the 79 revolution. And given that we are going to spy on other countries, we're going to intervene some way, it seems to me that could have been, instead of being referred to as an axis of evil, of some sort of possibility to foment from within a democratic solution.
This being a case in your mind, Brent, where if the United States had been a little bit more positive about the young people in Iran rather than being critical of the clerics there, they might have made more progress?
Yes, I really believe that could have made a difference, because I've seen so many documentaries and so forth about the young people in Iran,
yeah,
who are clamoring for some freedom, you know, newspapers that open up one day and are shut down the next by the,
yeah,
clerics.
Let's hear from Thomas on this. Thomas Carruthers, this is something you study. What do you think?
You know, the Iraq War had a very complicated effect on Iranian society. And on the one hand, you know, keep in mind that Saddam Hussein was a tremendous villain in Iran. He'd waged a war against the country. And at some level, people are glad he's gone and probably glad somebody got rid of him and they didn't have to do it. On the other hand, it makes them very nervous to have U.S. troops so close to their border and to have a military intervention carried out in that way. And so there's a lot of divided feelings, I think, within Iran. But the deeper question of, can the United States do very much right now in Iran to promote democracy, is an especially hard one. There is a lot of pro-American sentiment among young people out of frustration with their own government, with the constraints that it imposes on people, and that's led to a situation where people are champing at the bit for change.
Mm-hmm.
But this is a country where it's very difficult for the United States to do the kinds of things it did in Ukraine for a number of reasons. The legacy of our, you know, support for the Shah has left scars there which are hard to overcome. The government is more controlling in Iran and leaves less space for that kind of foreign support for civil society and so forth. And the fact that this is a country which has been undergoing some kinds of democratic change over the last 20 years, slow and partial and pulled back in some ways by the mullahs, but has had a reformist government get elected and then fail and be replaced by a more conservative one. So we have to be very wary about Iran as a target for a concerted American campaign to try to promote political change there. We need to support it, but we're going to have to be very careful about stepping on our own toes and then stepping on the toes of people in that society as we try to do so.
And there are two other factors that I'd like to bring up. And one is that despite the sort of the mixed legacy that the U.S. has and the sorry legacy in some cases of in its relationship with the Shah and its backing for a formerly repressive regime and meddling in the affairs of Iran, there is a very, very high degree of attachment to the United States among among younger people as a form of protest against the constraints of the theocracy. The second factor is that what happens in Iraq. If Iraq has a politics where the mullahs, the Shia mullahs of Iraq, behave in with greater moderation and with greater distance, and you have a pious religious leadership that doesn't interfere directly in politics, and you have the example not only of toppling the guy who killed a million of your own people in a war, but the establishment of a country in which the Shia, as the majority, are able to rule. That also has, I think, some limited implications for the Iranians and could have positive effects. So I think Tom is right to point out all of the downside of the intervention, but there may be some if things smooth out and develop and calm down, and there is a sort of a moderately functioning quasi-democratic state in Ukraine, that may have some impact and influence in the way Iranians think about what they can do in terms of their own society by peaceful means.
But there was a report that came out from the UN, I think just yesterday, written by a number of Arab intellectuals, being very critical of America's attempts to build democracy in the Middle East, saying in particular, what's the point in ever giving a small amount of money to Palestinians to help them to build a democracy, while at the same time the U.S. gives a significantly larger chunk of money to Israel, which in the view of the Arab intellectuals simply allows the occupation of Palestinian land to continue. And I mean, I haven't seen the full text of the report, rather just a newspaper report about it. But you think about this in the minds of Egyptians and Saudi youth and people like that, and you end up with a review of America in the Middle East looking very much like a country that really only looks after its self-interest rather than putting democracy first. Is that fair?
Yes. I mean, this is Thomas Carruthers. There's a lot of really profound skepticism in the Arab world about the new American stance of supporting democracy in the Middle East, and we're going to have to work long and hard to overcome that skepticism. First of all, they say, wait a minute, for decades you've been supporting dictatorial regimes in this region, especially Saudi Arabia and Egypt and others. How is it that you wake up one day and suddenly can't sleep or can't live without democracy in the Middle East when you lived with it for so long? Secondly, they're not happy with American policy towards the Palestinians and feel like if you don't really support Palestinian rights, how can you really talk about democracy? And then third, there's just a general hesitancy about the Iraq war and feeling that America intervened without really anybody's permission in the Arab world. America's occupying a large swath of Arab territory there. So for quite a few reasons, Arabs are very skeptical. It doesn't mean the United States can't play a positive democratic role in the Middle East. The Bush administration is struggling to find a way to do that, and I think with some really new and good attention in the second administration. But we're starting in a hole, and winning that credibility isn't something that's just going to be done by speeches by the president. It's going to have to be followed up by quite a few actions that show that we're consistent, we're serious, we're willing to put resources in, and we're willing to take some risks with people whom we don't like coming into power, but who might be more democratic than those that they're replacing.
We've got a number of people who want to get in, and I want to make sure we include our callers here. So let me, if I can, go next to Melrose, Massachusetts, and Jacqueline's on the line. Hi, Jacqueline.
Hi. I think we'd be a much better example of democracy if we would use humanitarian means, humanitarian actions to show the merit of democracy, say, like, instead of ignoring what's happening and so many thousands dying every day, children dying of hunger in Africa, and the AIDS problem being so huge and enormous, and, of course, the genocide in Sudan, if we would show more interest in helping, really, people who are struggling to even exist, we'd be a better example of democracy instead of spending about $343 billion every year on our military and going into these two countries and trying to stuff democracy down their throat by killing so many.
You're not necessarily, Jacqueline, saying that we or the United States should be spending more money on different countries, but spending the money better rather than in military terms, in humanitarian terms. Is that a reason?
Yes. We're at the lowest level, I think, now of popularity in the, around the world ever. And Madeleine Albright read recently, a few months ago, on one of the TV shows, of all the countries in the Middle East and in Europe who are afraid we're going to attack them. That's the reputation we have around the world.
Right.
Not a very good for a democracy. And even China and Russia are afraid we might attack them. So by trying to stuff democracy down a country by killing tens of thousands of their people and destroying any chances for jobs and decent lives, we're not showing democracy as being a very good thing. And especially since they can see that we're spending so much out of our budget that we care about the militarism much more than we care about humanitarian helping people.
Okay, Jacqueline, I get your point. I'm going to ask Adrian to speak to you here. Adrian,
go ahead. I mean, I think humanitarianism is extremely important when there are urgent issues of famine and poverty, and the U.S. should make that a non-political agenda item and a priority. On the other hand, I do think, I mean, the issue of genocide was invoked in the case of Sudan. I think you can provide as much food and assistance, but refugee groups won't go to work and humanitarian groups won't go to work if there is a civil war and people are being butchered and killed. So then there is the risk under law, international law, we're told that there is a responsibility to protect. That suggests military intervention. So just simply saying, you know, if we just fed the people in Sudan, all would be well is just not true. The real brutality of this is that there is an ongoing civil war. The military is using all sorts of means, including militias, and they're trying to do sort of ethnic cleansing and wiping out of particular racial, you know, the African racial groupings and Christian minorities. Those kinds of issues can be solved partly through diplomacy, sanctions, and pressure, but sometimes if they fail, as in the case of Rwanda or other places, there is a responsibility to use force. Humanitarian intervention alone doesn't solve all
the issues. And are there times and places when the U.S. is or ought to be acting only through the UN rather than coming in with anything that has an American flag on it, simply providing that kind of support so the UN can present something that is slightly more global than coming from one country?
Yeah, certainly it should, but I just came back from Geneva for the UN Human Rights Council, and there's an extreme reluctance from governments not to mention to act, but even to denounce human rights violations. There's an effort to water down a resolution on Sudan that has even the slightest criticism of the government, and even that is having a hard time. So you know, sometimes the UN is paralyzed, and then mm-hmm. it raises, yes, it's the preferable means, and every effort should be given to try to work through the UN system, but actually the bodies that actually have a high degree of legitimacy that work fairly well are a lot of the regional bodies. The OAS has often, as a group, intervened to criticize election violations and human rights violations and tried to vigorously change things. ECOWAS, the Economic Community of West African States, has been played a mixed but pretty good role in trying to reverse, military coups and the like. And the Commonwealth, the British Commonwealth, has adopted a fairly strong, human rights plank. So it seems to me that if you can work, and the OSCE, the Organization of Security and Cooperation in Europe, has been a major player in judging elections as not being free and fair and trying to exert pressure and helping give legitimacy to the Orange Revolution and other mm-hmm. Other efforts to defend democratic rights. So, yes, I agree that we ought to work multilaterally, but I think sometimes the UN is just a dead end, and we then do have the option of some of these regional bodies.
Let's go to Natick, Massachusetts for our next call. Liliana is joining us from there. Hi, Liliana.
Hi. I really enjoy your program. Thank you, Dick.
Mm-hmm.
I'm calling to ask why there wasn't as much media coverage in North America about the elections in Moldova. And how does one decide? Is it just the, political strategies that guide our support for democratic movements in countries? And I really would like to hear more from the guests what they think about that. And
what do you think, Liliana? Do you think that if the U.S. doesn't have some kind of strategic interest in a country, take Moldova for example, that it's less inclined to want to become involved?
Unfortunately so, and in a naive way, I hope that it's the grassroots movement, the lay people in those countries that take matters in their hands, but the truth is that the financial aspect is a very important aspect. And, you know, Moldova being a very poor country that it is, it just can't do that on those grounds.
Fair to say, Thomas, that the U.S. then is a little selective here when it comes
Well, of course the U.S. is selective. We're a nation. We have our interests and we pursue them. And that democracy promotion may be idealistic in some ways, but it's also about national interests. But Moldova and Kyrgyzstan present interesting cases. In fact, there was some U.S. attention to Moldova more so than in the past. But there was the perception here in Washington, I think, among those who support democratic movements that there was less opportunity there because the Communist Party was positioning itself fairly skillfully to win the elections and the opposition was quite weak. Kyrgyzstan is a country where the United States quietly was fairly involved over the years in supporting democracy, but we don't really have many strategic interests in Kyrgyzstan. It's not an oil-rich country.
Right.
It's not strategically positioned so much. And so there are places where the organizations that support democracy around the world do try to act when it really isn't about strategic interests. At the same time, at a higher level, the White House and the State Department and other things, often attention is given to particular countries because of strategic interests. So it's a pretty difficult mix of things, and it's hard to just make a snap judgment and say the U.S. is only doing this for this interest or the other.
Adrian, I'm interested in just hearing your thoughts about what's ahead for Viktor Yushchenko here, because it's one thing for him and his party to replace Kuchma and company there, but he's looking at an unbelievable list of things that he's going to, people are expecting him to deliver, a transformation of the civil service and taxes and dealing with the Russians, not only in Ukraine but across the border, media reform, building an economy. We talk about it as a success, but it might not last. It still might not work. Is that reasonable?
Well, I think it'll last, but not necessarily because of the success or failure of Viktor Yushchenko. I think that the decisive challenge for Viktor Yushchenko is to ensure that the opposition to Viktor Yushchenko is basically consists of democratic alternatives. That is, a left-leaning alternative and a right-leaning alternative. And and also to get rid of the people who were involved in the murders of journalists and the people who are still in politics who have links with a lot of terrible criminal activity. Corruption and so forth, and the voter fraud. I mean, do you really want people to be competing for power who orchestrated an effort to manufacture 3 million votes that weren't cast in the last election and hope that, you know, and let them sort of just waltz back into power and then take over the election mechanism again? That's why all of the crimes of the past have to be within the rule of law pursued, investigated, and there should be no kind of backdoor deals that exonerate or amnesty or result in impunity for people who have done this. And that's a very, very important challenge. And by doing that, I think what he will assure is that there'll be sort of basically an evolution of the opposition forces into a more normal stance. And that's, I think, what Ukraine needs. The media are beginning to break, to differentiate a bit. A lot of the oligarchs still own some of the media, but some of the alternative media that were only on cable are now getting 15% to 20% audience share, and there seems to be more diversity in the media.
Quick last question,
and the Ukrainian economy
can,
is
Adrian.
Growing. That's sorry.
Just a quick last question, if I can. Bush promised Yushchenko $60 million. Congress cut it back to just a little more than half that. Is that worrisome for you?
No, because the economy is like, $70 billion. It's a growing economy. It's growing at $5 billion a year, and the government's revenues are about 30% of it. So it's getting $2 billion extra dollars outside. You know, the important thing is to promote investment, to get Ukraine integrated into the World Trade Organization, to get Ukraine moving towards European integration and the like. That's where the U.S. can be most helpful.
We're out of time. I want to thank both of you for being with me. Adrian, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Adrian Karnetsky, senior scholar at the Freedom House in New York, and Thomas Carruthers, thank you for being with us.
You bet. Good to be here.
Director of the Democracy and Rule of Law Project at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and author of a book soon to be released called Uncharted Journey, Promoting Democracy in the Middle East. We also talked this hour with Idil Basalov, chairman of the Coalition for Democracy in Bishkek, Kyrgyzstan. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.